broadcast out of New York City. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on Monday, November 19th, 2012. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on Progressive Radio Network every Monday live from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are available 24/7 on PRN.fm.
Today you're going to hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after and 22 the hour. And we got another great show for you today that's going to include values and dangers of electronic medical records.
And does meditation change the brain responses?
Is meditation worthwhile as a treatment for heart disease?
And is automatic writing a fake?
What? Automatic writing? That's a good one. And can you hear the soundtrack of the human brain? Now we're getting out there.
And if you'd like to join in our conversation and have questions about our topics or your health, give us a call on Mondays from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time or 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time on PRN.fm at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Can you believe that Thanksgiving is already just around the corner?
Boy, that's that time of year when you're going to gain an average of 8 pounds by the time Christmas comes by. So start your diet early.
You got
3 more days to go on your diet.
Oh, my goodness. Well, anyway, I hope everybody has a happy Thanksgiving and that they remember to count their blessings, whether they have a diesel. That isn't diesel, but diesel.
There you go. That's right.
I shouldn't just advertise that one, but that's a pretty well-known, really good organic kind of turkey.
Sure.
And also, some people like to have tofu turkey, but make sure if it is that it's organic.
That's, I'll say, for sure.
And also, you know, Thanksgiving is that time of year where, besides eating a lot, people drink a lot. A lot of people get stressed in their preparations or because of family people and things, you know, it's not always so smooth. And sometimes just because they get sad because they're missing some of their relatives that have passed. Because, you know, over the years, there's different generations that come up. You know, you miss your grandparents and your great aunts and uncles and cousins and people like that. And then you're down to your kids. You're the oldest ones, and your kids and your grandkids and that kind of thing. So,
well, it's a great time of year to give thanks. You know, we forget about that.
Yeah, and that's the main thing. Actually, we should remember to give thanks every day. I read something not too long ago that was very impressive to me, and it got me into that habit of every day I give thanks for 5 things.
Oh, my goodness.
You can find 5 things. Everybody can find 5 things. So many times we focus on the things that we're, you know, that are bugging us or that we're unhappy about and that kind of, you know.
We should have that, and we should have a good news newspaper service, one that just talks about the good things and gives thanks every single day.
That would be a big seller. Actually,
well,
especially on Thanksgiving, that would be a great thing to do.
Well, it's the right time of year.
At least on the first page.
I'll see.
And what can people do when they are planning to eat a lot? Is there anything they can do in preparation?
Well, get your antacids out. Take your vitamin E and your vitamin C right after your meal, because your blood is going to be thick as glue after that. Exercise after you go ahead and have that big meal. And maybe don't just have that meal where you gorge yourself. You don't have to eat the whole turkey and all the pumpkin pie, even though it's pretty darn good.
Is it? Because it's so tempting. And, you know, you might want to prepare with enough sleep because a lot of people go shopping on Black Friday, and now I heard that it's going to start on Thanksgiving evening. They're not even waiting until Friday, so it's Black Thursday or something.
It's Black Friday for doctors, too, because it's the busiest day of the year in the office or in the emergency room.
The day after, huh?
The day after. I remember when our call group would get together to decide who was going to take call on that day. We all wanted to avoid that one because we knew we were going to have to work too hard.
Anyway, I hope everybody catches their flights and can eat in moderation and not get so stressed. Maybe practice a little meditation because we're going to get talking about that today.
I'll say.
So, a doctor's time, patient communication with doctors and health insurance restrictions and coordinating patient care, medical record accessibility, and teamwork within our health system have been a challenge. And the majority of doctors now use electronic medical records. Do you think that electronic medical records are the answer, and what are they?
Well, it's certainly part of the answer, because we can certainly, we can use that in order to communicate better with our patients, to maybe make insurance problems a little bit easier to solve, to lower the cost of healthcare because we don't have to do so much in the way of visits, to coordinate care between doctors and consultants and hospitals, and just better accessibility. It's very good for that. So, yeah, I'm for that. And a study was done in a journal called Health Affairs in November 2012, just this month. And a survey of 10 countries was included in that, and including the U.S. And what they found after interviewing these 8,500 primary care doctors is that they were pretty upset with the kind of health care that was being delivered in this country. And only about 11% of doctors said they had the information they needed when it was available, which is amazing, because you'd think when people's lives are at stake, that communication shouldn't be the thing that slows it down.
And not only is there a telephone, there's fax machines and courier services and things that they could do to make that a priority to get the information across to the primary care physician.
Well, that's really true. And I think we need to, we need electronic medical records. I think that that will increase the ease of care immensely. I like the idea of being in touch with my patients and having them be able to email me, too.
Well, also, are there other things that it could help with? Could it help with health insurance, coordinating the patient care? Because doctors, I know, spend, and doctors' offices spend a lot of time with health insurance.
Well, we doctors do, too. I'd say 5 minutes of every 15-minute visit is red tape that we're trying to figure out what to do. It's very inconvenient. We become very much involved with the technology of insurance. We've got a manual now that's got 10,000 different diagnostic codes in it. You can imagine that.
That's just overwhelming.
If you don't put the right code
in, how could
in,
anybody remember a code?
Well, you can't remember them for sure, and that's why there's that. I mean, and there's a lot of conditions you can have, but it really serves to the advantage of the insurance company, because what it does is allows them to say, oh, you got the wrong code here. We're not going to reimburse unless you do that. And, oh, by the way, no, we can't reimburse for that service that you did because you don't have the right codes. It gets to be a real mess.
So they keep they use it to procrastinate in pain, I guess.
Well, that's right.
Many times.
And, of course, that's money in the bank. If you don't have to pay it, it's there drawing interest, or you're not having to get a loan to pay it. But I don't think the insurance companies have to worry about getting loans. They've got so much money, it's crazy.
So do you think you'll be getting it? So,
well, it's a law. I think by next year or the year after, it's going to be required. There's no way around it. And the part about that I don't like is that there are going to be national standards, and it's going to be like big brothers looking over you if you're a doctor.
So it'll be tough to practice any complementary alternative medicine, I guess, because that won't be in their codes, I don't think.
Well, a lot of it won't be in their codes, and it won't be reimbursable, and patients will be upset and will be upset. And the government can also see exactly what you're doing. You know, Obama talks about trying to generate more income because of what they call Medicare fraud or insurance fraud, because doctors sometimes are trying to get reimbursement for services that aren't covered. So it's going to be very transparent from the doctor's end of it, and we're going to lose the tremendous advantage we have of being a real healer and being able to provide one-on-one care that's very unique for each patient, because everybody's different.
And what about a patient's privacy?
Well, that's another problem, because it won't be private anymore. At least they'll tell us it'll be private, but it isn't really, because there's a record of it someplace. So the idea of getting electronic medical records provides a wonderful service on one hand and a terrible service on the other. I mean, everybody's different. I don't have any two patients that are the same that have a single condition.
So in other words, it's going to be like one size fits all.
In many ways, that's true. I mean, every person I treat with hypertension is treated specifically to their needs, and they're all different. Same thing with type 2 diabetes. Same thing with endocrine problems. The same thing with obesity. They're all different.
And I know
different.
Many times you treat people with lifestyle. When you say about diabetes or hypertension, times they can be treated with lifestyle, and they don't have to have medication. Now, do you think that the government system would require you to give them medications? Because a lot of these medications have side effects that are not good.
Oh, they're dangerous. They should never be used as the approach unless patients are just refusing to do anything. And that usually means that as a doctor, you haven't made it clear to people and how important lifestyle is, and you haven't worked with them to solve it. There are a lot of programs that can be developed for people who have type 2 diabetes. And it's really simple most of the time what to do. I would say almost all cases of type 2 diabetes can be resolved without medication if you have a compliant patient or a patient who's inspired to do the right thing. Because you're talking about weight reduction, exercise, stress reduction, making sure you get enough sleep, certainly avoiding sugars of all kinds. So there's a lot that we can do that is specific to lifestyle approaches.
We've been complaining for a long time that we don't have medical freedom. And this would cinch it up.
Well, it would. And what Vicki means by that is we don't have the right to get the kind of care that we want. Our forefathers didn't put in the U.S. Constitution the right for medical freedom. That means that we don't get to make the choice of what we want. And the way things are set up, if you don't get reimbursement for a service, you basically are being discriminated against because you don't have the funds to pay for it out of pocket. That's a serious problem. And we can't go through life with that disparity because it's not right. So we have to change our laws. We need to go to Congress. We need to have an amendment that gives us the right if we want to do an alternative medicine for cancer, for example. You don't want to do chemotherapy. Let's say you have stage 4 cancer. Okay, it's metastatic. It's everywhere. The chances of being alive using mainstream therapies at 5 years is 2.1%. You believe that? 2.1%. And yet people are still taking the chemotherapy because doctors have basically convinced them that that's the only hope that they have, because in a state like California, it's a felony to treat cancer with anything besides chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery. And yet there are all these other kinds of approaches that can be taken that are less expensive, that work just as well from the experience that I've seen, and are safe. You can't say that about most chemotherapies. Fact is, if you have an advanced cancer and you take most chemotherapies, even especially the newer ones that are out there that haven't been tested so well because they're new, you're not going to have the kind of response that you want.
This is why a lot of people end up going out of the country.
Yeah, they're forced
to get therapy.
I mean, who would want to take a chemotherapy that's going to be expensive, not safe,
and make you sicker than a dog?
Yeah, I mean, and then live a month longer or 2 months longer?
Miserable, then, well, by then you'll want to die.
Well, yeah, that's right. So we need to have, we deserve to have, we should have the right to the kind of treatment that we want.
And also, they can take your children away from you if you don't want to give them chemotherapy.
Well, if the kids have a cancer, that's happened many times. Same thing with kids that have AIDS, and et cetera, et cetera.
Well, we talk about choice and freedom of choice. We need that with medical care and health care. It seems like too many rules can just stymie the progress, and yet we do need supervision, and we do need some safety.
Right.
So there's good things about medical records, and then there's things that are kind of scary about it.
Well, the question is what is the best form of a medical record that you want, medical records to have? It's clearly electronic. You do want to have the advantages of that, but you don't want the government, okay, the federal government supervising all 50 states. It's not right. Each state perhaps should have its own rules.
Pretty soon we won't even have doctors. They'll just go online and go to this program, and it'll say whether you can have this drug or not and refill your prescriptions. And
well, you've got a point. I mean, medicine is becoming very, very organized and set in
going
a way
back to that patient in room 456, you know,
right,
and not the person's name, just the number.
It's the gallbladder in room 425 or the heart attack in CCU. And then you have to make sure you're giving the right treatment for what the government thinks. So there we are. I think we need to wake up from the powers that the government has, and yet at the same time, we need to do something to make sure the disparities in healthcare are changing in a way that people can get the health care that they need. But when you have a system where the doctors are on the line because all of their treatments are listed and there's a record of it, and if you do something that's different, what we're going to have is a real problem of how we're going to go about providing health care that's fair to people. And the disparities are gone, but not having Big Brother doing all the things that Big Brother does to watch us. I mean, we're looking at a socialized state in many ways. And believe me, I'm not a Republican. I'm definitely someone who believes that some of the changes that Obama is talking about are the changes we need. We need to have universal health care. I mean, it's a sad thing that we don't have access to that because the disparities in healthcare are huge. And when you look at the Affordable Care Act, it's certainly not doing the things that you as a patient want to see happen.
Well, there are some good things about it, and yet there's, yes, you know, there's the good with the bad.
Well, there's 30 million more people who are going to get health care. That's a good thing. But the amount of money that's going to go into paying for that's not going to change. There are just going to be 30 million more people there.
And so then everybody's going to be, it'll be diluted, so everybody will be getting a little less.
That's exactly how it is, and you don't want that. And yet at the same time, the system that we have, in my opinion, is not repairable. I don't think we can fix the healthcare system we have. And certainly most of that reason is because we have people in Congress who are very much responsive to corporate America that's interested in making money more than it is in providing service. And as long as we have a system that's like that, then what matters is the bottom line, which is how much money are you making. And when you have that kind of a system, you'll be spending more than any other country in the world by 50%, by 100% actually in most cases, as we are in the U.S. We spend over $8,000 a year per person to deliver health care in this country. And the amount,
not everybody's getting that, so, you know, obviously, a lot of people are getting more.
Well, that's right.
If they're really sick.
Well, that's right. So these are the kinds of things that we're dealing with. And if we don't make some changes soon, we're just going to continue this downhill spiral that's delivering disparities in health care that cost too much, that aren't safe, because about a million people a year die in some way from medical treatment, which is a staggering number when you think about it. I mean, you have 400,000 people who are having a problem just with deaths from antibiotics. So there we are. We need to do something that's a little bit different, and we need to wake up to that.
So, you know, if anybody has any questions or they want to join in our conversation, give us a call. The number here at Prescriptions for Health is 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. That's a lot of eights.
All right. And so we'll be back in just a minute after Vicki's 2020 tip with, is meditation a worthwhile treatment for heart disease? So stay tuned with us.
So here's one for the ladies. And it's good to have a little laughter for the best medicine. After 17 years of marriage, a man dumped his wife for his young secretary, and his new girlfriend demanded that she wanted to live in the former couple's multi-million dollar home. And since the man's lawyers were a little better than his former wife's, he prevailed, and he gave...
That sounds like trouble to me.
Well, he gave his now ex-wife just 3 days to move out. Well, she spent the first day packing her belongings into boxes and crates and suitcases, and on the second day she had the movers come and collect her things. But on the third day, she sat down for the last time at their beautiful dining room table by candlelight, and she put on some soft background music and feasted on a pound of shrimp, a jar of caviar, and a whole bottle of Chardonnay.
All right, live it up.
Well, when she had finished, she went into each and every room and deposited a few half-eaten shrimp shells dipped in caviar into the hollows of the curtain rods.
Oh, nasty.
She then cleaned up the kitchen and she left.
Oh, no.
Well, when the husband returned with his new girlfriend, all was bliss for the first few days. Then slowly the house began to smell. Well, they tried everything, cleaning and mopping and airing out the place, and the vents were checked for dead rodents, and carpets were steam cleaned, and air fresheners were hung everywhere. The exterminators were brought in and they set off gas canisters, during which the newlyweds had to move out for a few days. And in the end, they even paid to replace the expensive wool carpeting. Well, nothing worked. People stopped coming over to visit. Repairmen refused to work in the house. The maid quit. Finally, they couldn't take the stench any longer, and they decided to move.
Oh, no.
Well, a month later, even though they had cut their price in half, they couldn't even find a buyer for their stinky house. So word got out, and eventually even the local realtors refused to return their calls. Finally, they had to borrow a huge sum of money from the bank to purchase a new place. Well, the ex-wife called the man and asked how things were going.
Oh, with a little innocent smile.
So he told her the saga of the rotting house. And she listened politely and said that she missed her old home terribly and would be willing to reduce her divorce settlement in exchange for getting the house back. Well, knowing his ex-wife had no idea how bad the smell was, he agreed on a price that was about a tenth of what the house had been worth.
Oh my God.
But only if she were to sign the papers that very day. So she agreed, and within the hour, his lawyers delivered the paperwork. A week later, the man and his new wife stood smirking as they watched the moving company pack everything to take to their new home, including the curtain rods.
Oh, no. Talk about getting even.
Gotcha.
Don't mess with an ex-wife, so I can tell you.
Well, he was even...
Beck, don't mess with any wife.
Well, he was nasty at the end. I mean, he
I'll
was
say.
Trying to put that on her, so...
Well, she didn't have anything to do with that, did she? All right, the lines are open. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Lynn Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. If you have a question about your health, give us a call.
There are different types of meditation with different results, and we often hear of focusing on our breath and letting our thoughts go, and guided meditation with an intention, and transcendental meditation. And studies are showing that meditation can show us how we process emotions and produce sustained changes on brain function long after meditating.
Right.
What are the different types of meditation in the frontiers in human neuroscience, where a study shows different forms of meditation may have varying effects in the brain?
Yeah, this is really a cool study, because what it's showing is that the effects of meditation are lasting on pathways in the brain, which is pretty amazing. And because you'd think that when you're meditating, okay, you can create a new pathway, and that might do something to make you look at things a little bit different. But this was really different. What they did is they did a functional MRI 3 weeks before and 3 weeks after a course to assess the activity of the amygdala, which is the processing part of the brain that looks at things and puts value on them. And what they did is they found that in mindfulness meditation, which is where you have an attention on your breath, on thoughts, and on emotion, that there was a marked improvement in how these people looked at images that showed people who were suffering. The ones that showed images that were positive or neutral and that were negative, in the people who were getting the mindfulness meditation, there was less stress, less activity in the amygdala, which is what you want. But in the people who had the other kind of meditation, the compassion type of meditation, what happened is when these people went through the course and they looked at it after the course was over and did this functional MRI on their brains when they were looking at images, when they looked at images where they were suffering, the people were suffering, or somebody was, something was suffering, there was an increase in stimulation of the amygdala, which means that there was a lasting effect from the meditation that they had learned, and it was still happening. So it's very interesting that this kind of meditation is out there and that it's been tested, and we know that it has a very powerful effect.
Well, it's really good to know that that effect can last, and that it's not like just right while you're meditating. You know, nowadays stress is like the biggest cause of disease, and I think it's a major complaint that your patients have. And
well,
so,
there are no patients that come to me that don't have stress. Everybody has stress, and you need a little bit of stress. Otherwise, we'd all be on Mount Olympus contemplating our navel. There would be nothing to do. But if you have a lot of stress, then things start to happen. And it's a sustained kind of stress that causes our bodies to start to have problems. So when you don't sleep right, for example, your risk for diabetes and for hypertension and for cancer and for osteoporosis all go up substantially. So stress is something that we need to pay a lot of attention to and deal with in a way that can help protect us from getting these diseases.
So it's really good to know that if people can take the time to meditate, whichever type of meditation that they do, that it can have lasting effects. So so even if they did it, I don't know, a couple of days ago, that it could still have some...
Oh, it might be 2 weeks ago or a month ago or a year ago. I mean, this is something that's really good to know. It's a powerful kind of treatment that's a little bit different from some of the other treatments where relaxation is involved. It's not the same as a massage. It's not the same as hypnotherapy. It's not the same as psychotherapy. It's not just other forms of relaxation. This is a specific thing where you have a presence of mind in the moment, and you let thoughts come and go through your mind, and just let them go.
You know, a lot of it is being present, isn't it?
It certainly is. That's what it's mostly about. Because, see, our gift when we were born and we're alive, the gift is that we're present tense people. Meaning that all we have experience for is in the moment right now. We can't experience the future. We've already experienced the past. But the right now is a lot different. And we have instant after instant after instant where we're in the present tense. And if we spend time there, there's no limit to how deep you can go in the moment. And I would say meditation is one of the deepest places. Trances would be another thing. Rich would be another thing that gets you into that deep place of centering that takes you into the moment very deeply.
For me, it's being in nature.
Well, nature can do that. That's a tool. And we are built for that.
Well, sometimes when I'm horseback riding, you know, I always go with somebody, and many times we end up talking and so forth, and then I'll stop and I'll think to myself, as long as I'm talking, I'm not really being present. So when I stop and then I start feeling the trees and the nature and listening to the birds and all that kind of thing, it's like it's a live meditation for me personally. That's how I react to it. And then, too, I'll never forget that book. Leo Biscogli, I think, is the author of the book, The Precious Present. I would recommend people read that. It only takes, like, I don't know, a half an hour, not even a half an hour to read it, probably 15 minutes to read this book.
That's a great point, Vicki. It's time for a PRN.FM station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Swit here with Nurse Vicki. The lines are open at 888-874-4888. We'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. And we'll be talking about, when we come back, does meditation change brain responses in heart disease? So stay tuned for more Prescriptions for Health Radio. Listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Swit here with Nurse Vicki. The number, if you have a question about your health or about what we're talking about, is 888-874-4888.
Well, meditation isn't just helpful for our emotional state. We all know that meditation, you know, helps us to relax and let go of our stress. And now there's new research showing that those who meditate regularly can reduce their chance of a heart attack, a stroke, or all-cause mortality by almost 50%. So with heart disease, the number one killer in the world, this is important information. And this particular research published in the American Heart Association journal Circulation happened to be on transcendental meditation. And transcendental meditation is basically allowing your mind and your body to rest with your eyes closed while you're remaining alert. So tell us more about this study.
Okay, well, it was published, as you said, in the journal Circulation, the American Heart Association's journal, this month of 2012. And basically, they looked at heart disease and people who did meditation. And they found that they had, like you said, a 50% decrease in heart attacks, strokes, and all-cause mortality over 5 years. Now, that's a pretty impressive thing. And it's not just TM itself. That, by the way, is a trademark for a patented system that's quite expensive. But regular meditation should work just as well.
Well, they actually, the researchers found that regular meditation was correlated with the same thing.
Yeah, they said that. So that was a good thing to do. Well, basically what meditation does, as you look at it from this point of view, is lower blood pressure, lower stress, and lower anger. They found that the more TM that was done, the less mortality there was. And by the way, this study came out of the Medical College of Virginia. What they're trying to say is that meditation turns on the body's pharmacy and basically is regulating through relaxation and the neurotransmitters and the hormones and all the enzymes that we have a state of relaxation. But I have to tell you that we have that, our pharmacy is working all the time. It's not just
there. When you say it turns on the body's pharmacy, you mean it's helping us to repair and maintain our bodies.
That, and to relax us and to give us the feeling of being in the moment. All those things have a biochemical reflection, a biochemical explanation. But you have to keep in mind that the biochemistry isn't what's running the show usually. It's everything else that's happening in our minds. It's regulating our biochemistry and our physiology. So we don't want to get that backwards.
Well, how would you say that meditation compares to other lifestyle factors like diet and exercise and sleep?
Well, it's one more thing to add in there that has to do with relaxation and lowering stress levels. So, I mean, the lifestyle factors that we have of diet, exercise, stress reduction, sleep, weighing what you should, avoiding toxic exposures and having a meaningful purpose in your life are very much in line with having a state of meditation that it puts you in the moment as deeply as you can.
So when we talk about how it helps to lower blood pressure, just think about the white coat syndrome regarding blood pressure. You know, many patients, they go to the doctor's office, they're in a hurry, and then they're anxious, and maybe they're scared that their blood pressure is going to be high because they know that their blood pressure is going to be taken.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens? Their blood pressure goes up.
Well, that's right.
So I was thinking it would be really nice in waiting rooms if there was something to encourage people to meditate. Now, I know in your waiting room, you have soft music often that's playing to help people.
Well, I like to make people feel relaxed and comfortable. I think one of the skills of a healthcare practitioner who's a healer is to be able to listen to people and care about them and let them know that. And part of it is relaxing them, because there's nothing like having a patient who has hypertension come in to have their blood pressure checked. They're on various different kinds of treatment protocols for it. And then you put them in you make them wait, first of all, because usually you're a little bit late. Then you put them in a cold room, okay, and they don't have much on because you're going to examine them. And then you come in and take their blood pressure, and lo and behold, you find it's high. Like, duh. I mean, what would you expect? How many people do you think are out there being treated for hypertension
that don't have it?
Because the best way to take a blood pressure is not in the doctor's office.
It's to take it yourself.
Yes, you take it at home a couple times. And I find that people sometimes will have blood pressures as high as 200 over 120. And I won't start them right on treatment there. But I'll talk to them about saying, let's take your blood pressure on a regular basis when you're not here. Because some people, they just get psyched out by being in the office because they're afraid of doctors and afraid they're going to find something wrong with them. And they're going to have to take a bunch of pills or have an operation, or you're going to tell them that they've got a shortened lifespan. That's not a thing that relaxes you. So this whole business about being in a relaxed state is huge.
Well, I know Stephen Halpern has some wonderful, wonderful music that some of it even have some little subliminal messages to relax.
It's beautiful stuff. I highly recommend Stephen Halpern's CDs. Go to your store where you buy CDs and try one. You won't be disappointed.
Well, you can even get, listen to samples of his music online.
You just put Stephen Halpern in the search box of Google, and up will come his stuff. It's interesting because it's a music you can't predict. It's sort of, it goes in ways that you can't track.
You can't anticipate what's coming next, which is distracting sometimes in some types of music. So that's what's especially good about his. So anyway, it's helpful to meditate for more than one reason, isn't it?
Well, yes.
And it's nice to know that it lasts.
Well,
and that it can also extend our life.
Well, it does a lot of things that make a difference. It lowers blood pressure, it lowers stress levels, it lowers anger, and this study showed all that stuff. And if we continue to be cognizant of that, what we'll find is that there's going to be a whole lot of things that change in the way of our health that's very positive, because what you think definitely affects our biochemistry and physiology. So you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on PRN.FM. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's 2020 health tip on the law of the garbage truck. Where the heck did you find that title, Vicki? And when we come back, we're going to get out there talking about, is automatic writing fake? And can you hear the soundtrack of the human brain? We'll be right back after Vicki's tip.
Last week when we talked about how stress comes from our reaction to stressors and not so much the stressors themselves. Well, life is 10% about what you make it and 90% about how you take it.
Absolutely.
I wanted to tell you this story. One day I hopped on a taxi and we took off for the airport, and we were driving in the right lane when suddenly this black car jumps out of a parking space right in front of us, and my taxi driver just slams on his brakes, skidded and missed the other car by just inches, and the driver of the other car whipped his head around and starts yelling at us. Well, my taxi driver just smiled and waved at the guy, and I mean, he was really friendly.
He must have been in New York City. That's right.
So I asked him, why did you do that? That guy almost ruined your car and sent us to the hospital. This is when my taxi driver taught me what I now call the law of the garbage truck.
Oh my God.
He explained that many people are like garbage trucks. They run around full of garbage, full of frustration, full of anger, full of disappointment. And as their garbage piles up, they need a place to dump it. And sometimes they'll dump it on you. So don't take it personally. Just smile, wave, wish them well, and move on. Don't take their garbage and spread it to other people at work and at home or on the streets. So the bottom line is that successful people do not let garbage trucks take over their day. Life's too short to wake up in the morning with regrets. So love the people who treat you right and pray for the ones you don't.
Well, that's
because
really right.
Life is 10% what you make it and 90% how you take it.
That's so right. I think every good doctor, in fact, every person who wants to help another person, whether they're a doctor or not, should be taking note of what you just said. Because when you hear somebody who's angry or taking a position that's outrageous or is really upset or does something that's mean to somebody else or is a bully or all these things that they can be like, there's always a reason for it. And our job is to figure out what is that reason. And to try to help people work through it, because you want to be constructive. Otherwise, you're being destructive. You have a choice. You can make things better or you can make things worse by heightening the ante. I know a couple of weeks ago, a mother and a daughter came into my office and they were making a big fuss because the mother wasn't sure she wanted to be there. The daughter thought she was the one that should have the appointment, but she didn't have the funds to pay for it. And they were arguing like crazy. The whole waiting room was up in arms. And the patient who came in before her said, boy, you better watch out when those two come in there, because it's going to be mayhem. They're going to eat you alive. I said, don't worry about it. I said, I'll take care of it.
But he also asked you a question.
Well, he asked, who asked me a question?
The previous patient. Didn't he ask you if you didn't mind if he stayed in another room and just kind of like meditated on them or whatever he does?
Well, he did do that, and he happens to be a spiritual healer.
Yes.
So having his energy on board was a good thing. So after I saw the patient that I did, and only the two people were in the waiting room, I went out there and sat down. I had a big smile, and I said, oh, I'm so sorry that you're having a hard time here. Don't worry. We're going to work it out. Why don't you both come in, and I'll see you both at the same time? And by the time they left my office, they were smiling, they were happy, they saw the ridiculousness of how they were handling it.
Boy, it could have been just the opposite.
Oh, I could have got shot, you know, if they had a weapon in their possession. So it's always worth listening and caring. Those are the two biggest things that a physician can do.
Because and a husband.
Well, and a wife. That's right. Well, I have to admit, you're a lot better at that than I am. A lot of the time I'll come home and you'll say, so how'd things go today? I say, oh, I just saw a bunch of patients. And you'll go, well, talk to me. And I'm saying, I have things to do. Just a minute.
Yeah.
But I'm learning.
So don't be the garbage truck.
Don't be the garbage truck. Well, you have to be the healer, too, and all of us do. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
Well, here's a study bringing together science and spirituality when it comes to brain activity during psychography.
Or psychography. Where, yes, automatic that, writing, huh?
Yeah, that's where it's believed that a deceased person's spirit writes through the hand of the medium in a trance state. Mm-hmm. So how do you know if automatic writing is real or fake?
Well, that's a really good question. And I'd first like to address that automatic writing sounds crazy to most people who are just scientists. And the reason it sounds crazy to them is because they don't understand it. And about 200 years ago, when the apple fell on Newton's head, and we got the idea that science prevailed and that spirituality was just woo-woo stuff, we relegated the art and the science of spirituality back to the church. And we abandoned anything that had to do with it because we didn't know about it. We weren't smart enough to say, here's a black box. You put a nickel in and a quarter comes out. And you're going, whoa, I don't understand that, so I'm going to throw the box away. Now, that doesn't make any sense from a scientific point of view. And because we're all an inseparable part of the whole universe, this is stuff that we should be paying attention to and studying. And fortunately, the Public Library of Science Online in this month, November of 2012, that was published by Thomas Jefferson University and the University of São Paulo in Brazil, they studied the spirits that write through a medium's hand. And the stuff was very interesting. They had 10 mediums, 5 that were really experienced and 5 that were newbies. And they did spec scans on them so they could see where the metabolic activity and the brain action was. And they looked at people who were experienced and newbies, and they found that there were lower levels of several brain functions at the time automatic writing was being done. And these changes were a big surprise because they didn't really expect to see anything because they thought maybe it was just hocus pocus.
So basically what happened is that their reasoning went to sleep?
Yep.
And so this showed that something really was happening because it would be hard to explain it any other way. How could a person be writing complicated information down and not be thinking, actively thinking?
That's
and
right.
Having it just flowing. So in other words, it's flowing through them.
So there were a lot of places, Vicki, where there was a lower level of activity where you wouldn't expect to see that, such as in the hippocampus, which has a lot to do with our emotions, and with the frontal lobe regions of the brain, where we tend to be focused on planning and languaging and movement and problem solving, which came as kind of a surprise to everybody, because not understanding what automatic writing could be like, they weren't really that open to it. And I think the idea might have been in part to prove that there wasn't anything to do with it, and it was all a bunch of crazy people doing psychotic things.
So they were surprised. A few years ago, well, actually several years ago now, we went to Brazil to visit John of God, mm-hmm. and he did some of that. I mean, he actually, I guess you call it channeling, but he would channel doctors from hundreds of years ago or whatever it was. He was practicing. He became them, actually, and afterwards he doesn't know anything about it or remember it or anything, but he did this with his writing, too. He would write out prescriptions for herbs and things, and not everybody's was the same. Oh. So that was kind of interesting. And then also, you know, when you think of the Course in Miracles, Helen Schuckman, who said that her inner voice was channeling from Jesus, and he told her to take notes. And so she took notes for 7 years, and she put together this whole Course in Miracles. there was a man that helped her, but she was the one that did all the writing. And it was just like automatic writing. She just kept coming through her.
Well, these are things that are strange we don't understand, and I think that the right attitude is to keep an open mind about that and to study it more. And, you know, a lot of things we don't understand, but we know exist. It's like that black box I was telling you about where you put a nickel on one side and a quarter comes out the other side. If you're smart, you don't have to understand the mechanism, but what you have to have is a lot of nickels, right? And so that's how we should approach these kinds of things that we don't understand. And the other thing is that, you know, we're an inseparable combination of body, mind, emotion, and spirit, and we're an inseparable part of the universe as well. So everything that happens, and most of it, we don't know the first thing about why it happens or even how it happens.
So maybe we don't need to understand.
That's the point. Yeah. I don't think understanding...
Do you think that this correlates with neurophysiology?
Well, yeah, that's why this particular study that's looking at SPECT scans is actually in a journal that's so prestigious as the Public Library of Science Online. I mean, this is a big thing. The other thing they noticed that was kind of interesting to me is that the complexity scores of people who did automatic writing was much more than if a person was experienced than if somebody was just a newbie at it. And the brain obviously is involved in transcribing all this information, and here we are. So we have to keep an open mind and appreciate that what we do a lot of the time we don't understand the mechanism of, but it's something that we really have to pay attention to and respect, or we're just going to miss out. The whole spectrum between science and spirituality is in one plane, and they are on the same plane, in the same spectrum, just at different ends of it. Science and spirituality are always congruent. It can't be any other way, because they are just ways of analyzing how things are. So if you want to put more of a spiritual bias on it, you can do that. If you want to put more of a scientific bias on it, you can do that. But they are both happening at all times, at every second. So that inseparability is something that is something we should pay attention to and realize that we don't have to understand that for it to be right. And it leads me to want to be changing the way we do medical research. We should be doing something called an outcome study, rather than the kinds of studies that we do that we say are good science that are the worst kind of science that we do, especially in medicine. Our science is bunk for lots
especially
of reasons.
With all the conflicts of interest.
Well, that's one part of it, but the part that's really bunk is we throw out the most important part of the experiment every time.
The placebo part.
Yes, I mean, that's the most important part. It's the best treatment. You usually have about 30% of every experiment being placebo. And what's happened is the pharmaceutical companies don't like that, because what they want is to have a drug that does something so that you'll take it. And a lot of the time, maybe you get that 30% from placebo, and then maybe what you'll get is another 2 or 3 or 5% from the drug. They throw placebo out and say, it's scientifically valid and you should be using this drug, even though it's got a gazillion side effects that we're only going to tell you a little about because, one, we don't know that much about them because that's not our function. Our function is to make something that you'll buy.
Well, that's what's so great about what we were just talking about with the studies on the meditation.
Exactly.
Showing that, you know, that was, in fact, a fact.
Well, what treatment is better than something that is inexpensive, that's safe, that works? And we're going to throw that out? And you call that good science? It's the worst science on the planet. So we got to move over to this thing called an outcome study.
So we can't separate science and spirituality. And scientists have combined and translated two kinds of brainwave recordings into music.
What?
EEGs, the electroencephalograms, for the pitch and the duration of a note, and MRIs to control the intensity of the music.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this brain music has the possibility of helping a person move from an anxious state to a relaxed state. So tell us about this Chinese study and what this means.
Well, this is big time stuff, because what we're looking at here is the art, okay, of how the human brain works. And so what we do is We generally don't pay attention to things like that, but the Chinese people who have done this research have shown us that we're really interacting in very interesting ways by measuring functional MRIs at the same time as they're doing electroencephalograms, which are EEGs. And what they have come up with is a kind of music from that that is kind of stunning. It's a little bit like Stephen Halpern's music, because it's not in a way that you can predict what it's like, but it's a reflection of what's happening deep in our minds that explains, our from an outcome point of view, of what's happening. It's not just the biochemistry that's important here. We live in nature, and we unconsciously interact with sound, light, electromagnetic fields, gravity, and things like that in a harmonious way. And yet, we're an inseparable part of nature, but trying to be separate, which is a bizarre thing to try and do when you think about it.
So maybe there really is something to it when somebody says, oh, that's music to my ears.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed.
The way, going right into my brain.
Yeah. Well, that's really good stuff. And it's good that we understand that so we can waken up to our true inseparable relationship with all that there is on the planet. Now, the part that scares me about this is that Homeland Security was mentioned in this article as one of the organizations that was studying it. And, of course, you'd expect that, because Homeland Security has not exactly got a great reputation, because it's not our friend. It's sort of like Big Brother looking over all the things that are happening in the United States and then having some kind of power to either accept or reject it as being okay. Now, when you think of the potential of what sound could do to change the way your brain functions, it's scary, because it could be something that's subliminal that you don't even know is happening.
Gee, this it is could scary, be, like it could come out of your TV or your radio
bet,
or your
you
computer.
Bet, you bet. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's happening now, because of all the things that are happening with the conspiracy theories that are out there that just frighten you.
Well, sometimes it is sort of surprising the things that people go along with.
I'll say.
And accept.
Well, that's right, and that may be part of it. You wonder if elections are won and lost by things like that. I mean, who has access to Homeland Security? I mean, I don't trust Homeland Security any further than I can throw it. I don't like any part of a lot of what happens by the government as it's controlling some of the things that we're involved with. So we have to wake up to these things and realize that there's a whole science here that is something that's very powerful, that could be a wonderful tool. Wouldn't it be nice to just lay down and have a soundtrack play certain keys that are in certain sequences,
well,
and
so
have you get better?
So obviously everybody's brain music probably is different. It's all individual. And if you could listen to yours when you're relaxed, you know, wouldn't that be great? Because then if you're anxious or you're upset about something or you want to meditate or any of that, then you could just play this music of your own brain when it's relaxed.
Well, that would be one way to look at it, but the applications are far beyond that. You could treat hypertension or maybe cancer or maybe an infection using sound that instructs your brain how to respond from the point of view of your immune system or digestion.